Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we discuss what we learned in the 23-24 season. We open up the burn book, while over on the paid side, we discuss what Liverpool should do with Mo Salah, and we tell you our perfect day, as if you cared. That's all in this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So, welcome back to another episode. I'm joined by Pete Dorman, as always, who is adjusting to married life. Pete, how are you doing?
I thought you were about to say adjusting my hair at that point, which I was also doing. I'm unsure which one's more important.
It looks like it could not be adjusted. It looks like you'd need a chisel and a mallet to adjust it.
This is literally out of the shower. I showered about half an hour ago.
Huge flex. Unbelievable flex.
No product. Well, I mean, the £500 Dyson Airwrap that Jess owns, that was used in the drying process, but no product. Mm-hmm. Just almost put on a hat.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, it's just, what, out of shame?
Not so much shame, but just that if it didn't sit right, it would just annoy me, because I know we'll be on this call for about three and a half hours. And I don't know about you, right? This might be like peak narcissism here, but on the Zoom calls, I almost exclusively only look at myself. I feel like,
okay, good.
That's normal behavior. Yeah, cool. Right, I will. Okay,
me too.
Normal even between
when
us.
Even when I'm having therapy over Zoom, I'm looking at myself the whole time, yeah. And I've never told my therapist that, but it's probably a useful data point for her to know. I'm like, I've never looked at you in a session.
I'd be really interested to like farm this out to your wider audience in terms of polling. How many people actually? Where do you look on a Zoom call? Because I reckon 95% of the time I'm looking at myself, and the other 5% of the time I'm not looking at the screen.
Oh my God. I went through a period where I would move my picture down to the bottom right-hand corner, and then I would put something, I would prop like a, you know, like a book of post-it notes against the screen of my laptop so that I could not see myself. Yeah, because I was just like, this is like an addiction to something you hate. Like, I don't want to look at myself the whole time, but I can't stop doing it.
Yeah. And also, I don't know what your opinion of it is, but on a lot of Zoom calls, whatever happens between my face and the camera and through Zoom, a lot of the time I'm like, it fucking slaps.
Jesus.
But more so than usual, more so than it should.
Oh, definitely more than it should.
Yeah. And then you get humbled. Then you go to the toilet after the Zoom call and you get humbled by the bathroom mirror. And it's just like, okay, it brings you crashing back down to earth. So bathroom mirror is probably one of the three or four worst mirrors, or the most humbling mirrors. I think the most humbling mirror is the hairdresser barber mirror, just after you've had your hair washed as well.
Like, yeah, you're sitting there with wet hair. There's like the thing under your neck.
Yeah,
you know, pushing like up a double chin. Yeah. Thing. Yeah, exactly. It's grim. Yeah, that is bad. I also think a lot of changing room mirrors are really bad, which doesn't make sense to me, because if I had a shop, the changing room mirrors would be incredibly flattering with incredibly flattering lighting. But I feel like it's always top lighting, which is very unhelpful. You can't even see the color of what you're wearing. It's not good.
I think shops got into trouble because what they did with their changing room mirrors was they pitched them slightly forward, which then created an optical illusion of like a slimmer, taller, sleeker body. And then it was found out, and I mean, I'm neither here nor there about it, but like the body shaming police got on it, and it was a bit of a PR issue for the, I can't remember what company it was, but it was a reasonably big company. But yeah, they were like, but I agree with you, they should be, it's the same as like the reason gyms have downlights right in front of the mirrors, because
It makes you look unbelievably stacked.
So like, even though you're not that stacked, you're like, here, fuck, this is like paying off. This is my work in the gym is paying off. So it kind of galvanizes your desire to work out more. Changing rooms should do whatever that is. We've gone really off peak.
I feel like we've got quite off topic.
How are you, Patrick? I haven't asked you then.
I'm fine. Nothing to report, really. I'm hot. It's hot. We're hot boys today. Yeah, I'm in the loft. The loft is hot. I will open both windows in a minute and get a kind of like through breeze. But also, I just went through like double bath time. Like I walked home, the toddler wouldn't get in the pram, so we did a long walk home. So the journey home, which is about a 12, 13 minute walk with her in the pram, we went through stones in the river as well, because she likes to do that. And it was a 55 minute walk, like the two of us in the sun. And then I went straight into bathing the baby and then rejoined toddler bath time after the baby went down. Yeah, and then wolfed some food and ran up to the loft, walked into the loft, and I was just like almost pushed back out of the room by the warm air. So yeah, feeling good, feeling good.
You've been toasty for about 4 hours.
Yeah, man. And but you know what? I'm wearing, I finally pulled the trigger and got the Patagonia baggies.
Okay.
So I'm in the classic, you know, the iconic baggies shorts.
Right, okay.
And it feels good. It feels good. I like summer wear coming out. I do.
I've been in a real summer wear hole today. Trying to, obviously, because we're going away on our honeymoon in 4 weeks. And when I took, well, this probably won't surprise you, but I try an impressively little amount at work. And the fact that my honeymoon's coming up, this period, this 2 month period between my wedding and my honeymoon, I've even impressed myself with how little I care about work. You know the way you phone it in like the 2 days before your holiday? Like you just kind of like, oh, I'm going away for 2 weeks, you know, this issue that's happening right now isn't my problem. I'm doing that, but the problem is I'm trying to do that for 8 weeks. So all of the shit.
Yeah, I believe in you. I do think you are that good.
Like all of the shit I'm kicking down the road will inevitably still come back to me because it's too long. I can't kick it down the road for 8 weeks.
That's a fair point.
Okay. But yeah, we'll see. I've managed for a month so far. One more.
That's a problem for an older version of you, though.
Yeah.
It's not your problem now.
No, absolutely not. Thank God.
Yeah, that's the main thing.
Next week.
I mean, yeah, but sure. Again, we're not on the podcast next week, so fuck that guy. Who cares?
Yeah. You don't actually speak to that guy. You don't meet that guy.
Exactly. You never catch up to him. At the end of this, I think you should tell people exactly where they could find you during your honeymoon. You know, where they can send their cards to, where they can come and meet you, let them know your hotel room number, like all that kind of stuff. Like, let's just make sure that everybody's got the information so that as many listeners to the podcast can join you on your honeymoon as possible. I mean, obviously, though, of course, like there are all your friends and family who listen to the podcast. from your wedding. So
if they didn't, they will
know,
not.
But, you know.
Also, this podcast is getting a weird amount of traction within like the circles I know. So we had an end of season hockey dinner, like just a curry.
What?
On a Friday night or two Friday nights ago. And it then came out that I was like, oh yeah, you've got a podcast. And it got said like within the group. And then like that got a load of traction within like 4 or 5 people who were shocked that I had a podcast and were like wanting information about it, which is fine. I don't mind that.
Oh my God.
But it also means that it's a lot closer to home than I ever thought this would get.
Mm-hmm.
When we started this, I felt that this would be kind of like FD was, in that it was an audience quite removed, at least removed from your personal life. And like my mum and dad and friends never watched anything really that we did of FD. But
no, because I've got respect for them.
but now it's like there's an unsettling amount of people who I meet regularly who listen to this, and the stakes are quite high because I'll inevitably forget that at multiple points and say something fucking dumb
and talk shit about them.
Yeah,
that's true. I mean, look, I think this is more of a problem for you because I feel like your friends love you more than my friends love me, because none of my friends listen to this fucking podcast. But yeah, I agree. I kind of thought like, oh, it'll be like pleasant strangers who listen to this. And to be honest, it is like a self-selecting good group. Like I feel like the questions we get are really high standard.
Yeah.
I now have had some people say they listen to podcasts. You know, like recently, if I bumped into somebody who knew who I was, they would know me from FD. And obviously, they still know me from FD. But I've had a couple of, shout out to Luke, by the way, who I met in Soho the other day, who said, I listen to the podcast. And I was like, oh, this is one of the first, like, I listen to your podcast shouts I've had. But nobody in my life listens to it except for Jess and Emma. I think that's kind of it. Obviously, Olivia Dodd will never listen to a second of it. Otherwise, that friendship's over. But
what I find really funny at my wedding, you told me this, was that apparently my friend Richie, who listens to this, who lives in Sweden, has never met you or never met Olivia. When he met you, obviously he felt like he knew a lot about you because he listened to the podcast, which is fine. But also he immediately started like nagging Olivia.
Yeah.
Who he never met.
Sure, but I mean, I think that Olivia... Yeah, I think Olivia was just like, this is a friend of Pete.
Yeah. Okay, sure. So this is to be expected.
This is normal. Yeah. Yeah. And also, I think she was just like, that's what Olivia responds to.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it was like he'd... it was like he knew her, like, kind of secret Soviet programming code. Like, she was a sleeper agent, and he could just, like, say the thing that, like, activated her by being like, you look like shit or something. And Olivia is immediately like, do you want to be friends?
Girls usually can't pull off such greasy hair, but you're doing a pretty good job at it. Or something to that effect.
Oh my god. Yeah, it was actually great. Anyway. We always do this. But you know, that's what people turn up for, probably. So today we're going to talk about what we learned from this season. So obviously, I think it's been a particularly dramatic season. I mean, even this week, the Champions League semi-finals were unexpected, ridiculous. But the whole season, I think, has been tremendously exciting. Like, whether it's Bayer Leverkusen winning in Germany, whether it's one of the best Italian sides we've seen in recent years in Inter Milan, you know, the story of Girona in Spain or Villa in the Premier League, like a three-way title race in the Prem, like all sorts of interesting stuff going on. So we thought that we'd take a little look back at what we've learned, what's surprised us, what's been, I guess, unexpected this season overall. That said, I'm going to ask you to go first, Pete, and looking at the title of your first one, it's not the most unexpected, I would say. I guess it was going into the season.
So it's... Right, so I actually read an article that related to the topic we're about to speak of, and I think it was from Andy Mitten of the Athletic, and basically the title was like, United fans are just confused. And I think that really does reflect kind of where I'm at with Manchester United at the minute, because this isn't necessarily a shock, but also it's kind of the first time that I've really believed that I'm kind of just done with the club. Not done with the club in the sense that I'm like going to stop supporting him. That's obviously not how it works. I'm not going to stop supporting him. But
that's disappointing.
This United era, this United team is just like, it's just completely fucked. It's like, it's done, it's over. And this is the first time that I've kind of accepted that United are genuinely a bad team, because post-Ferguson, I've always said that United are kind of shit or they're very, very unreliable. But any kind of big negative thing I've said about United has always been met or followed up with a few like positive caveats. It's like, but we do this, this, and this, and I think everything gets a little bit better. I'm following up all the negatives with at least some form of optimism. And I think that's because United over the past like 5 or 6 seasons have done a very, very good job of having just enough success to make people think that like they're still trending in a positive way or brighter days are to come. You know, look at last season. Last season's a perfect example of that, because Erik ten Hag's first season, got Champions League football, finished third, 75 points, got to the FA Cup final, won the League Cup. And while the League Cup is a largely insignificant tournament, it still kind of showed that United were trending in a positive way for a first season under a new manager.
Sure.
But the reality of this year is far, far more dire than I expected. And I suppose that is where the kind of shock comes in. As it stands, United are on pace to finish with 58 points, which would be their joint worst points return in the history of Premier League. And they still actually have to play. Their 3 remaining games, I think, are Arsenal, Spurs and Brighton. 2 of those very losable. Wouldn't be surprised if they lose all 3. So there is
So the projection is saying, aren't they on 54 now?
So they're on 54 now at 1 point, something like 6 points per game.
And so the projection suggests that they... 50, but that like, means the projections that they're going to get 4 points from those last
so
games.
The projections across their whole 35-game season so far, but it's not taking into account the fact that... Like, that projection's literally just worked out by simple maths for me, not based on, like, Opta's difficulty ranking, which, if you take into account the fact that they need to play Arsenal, and I think Spurs... Oh, sorry, Newcastle. It's not Spurs, it's Newcastle. I mean, I knew it was another tricky team. So, Arsenal, Newcastle,
that's
Brighton,
arguably tougher.
Or the last, yeah, I would say, well, at home, still. United could easily lose 2, if not 3 of those games. United getting 4 points from those games, I think is actually a little bit of a stretch. So there is a real risk of United, like, statistically being the worst team, this United team, having the worst season in Premier League history for United. But even if they don't, I still think that there is a very, very strong argument to be made that they are, in fact, the worst team of United in the Premier League era. Like, this season, across all comps, they've conceded 81 goals, which is the most they've conceded since 1977.
In
they've
how many also, games?
So 35, about 50, probably.
Holy shit.
81 goals, all competitions. Because also, like, remember the Champions League? We were conceding 4 goals every week. Like,
yeah, that's true.
It racked up. So, yeah, most goals conceded in all comps since 1977. They've conceded 55 in the Premier League alone, which means that United have 1 point less than the amount of goals they conceded so far this season. That is staggering. They've also lost 13 games for the first time ever in a Premier League season. And,
really?
Yeah.
And for the first time ever? That's
they've
funny.
Conceded a record high of 618 shots so far this season. Bearing in mind, we still have 3 games to go and they've already broken the record. That's an average of nearly 18 shots conceded per game.
Haven't you conceded the most shots in the Prem now?
I think second most after Sheffield United.
Oh, come on, Pete. I think you could do that.
It might, yeah. Aim high. Any way you cut this season, it's a staggeringly bad season. And yeah, arguably the worst season of United's Premier League history. And
do you not think that's a positive? Just before we go on,
I think that's a positive.
No, it could get worse. I mean, I'm an Arsenal fan. I'm here to tell you it could get worse than this. But
why is this a positive?
A few years ago, I felt like I would talk to United fans and they would like argue with you about how their team was better than yours. And I was like, my team's crap. Like, I don't care which of our teams is better. You're crap, we're crap, doesn't matter. Like, but they would genuinely argue. They were like, oh no, we're actually really good. Or like, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is really good. Or whatever it was. It was just like, no, the team's actually great. Like, United fans would always try and make this argument why they were actually good, why they were better than you, why Rashford was better than, you know, whoever the good player was on your side, why Rashford was better than Sterling or something like this, I don't know. And I always was kind of like, this attitude is a problem because it prevents you looking squarely at the actual state of your club. And sometimes for the club to really do something, it does require the fans to get angry. And getting angry means recognizing the team is shit. If fans hadn't got angry, like, Unai Emery would have stayed at Arsenal for longer. And things weren't going to turn around under him. Like, I know that he's doing well at Villa now, but things weren't going to turn around for him at Arsenal. They just weren't. It does often require people to understand this is a dire situation and needs drastic remedies for a club to actually take notice, and especially at Man United, where like the Glazers are just going to do whatever if there's not genuine outcry among the fans. So I do think that if there'd been more outcry, if fans had been more like, no, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is not at the wheel, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is not good enough for this club, like this team like looks kind of good because we're like scraping into second, but we are actually crap when you watch us, I do think things would have taken a turn for the better earlier, and you could have had a better manager sooner, I guess.
That's kind of what I was saying about how United have done a very good job of doing just enough, achieving enough success. You know,
but I'm saying that just enough is actually like...
Yeah. That's what I meant. It's like damaging because it kind of fills you with false hope. And that's kind of where I've been at. I think my approach is a lot more rational than probably a lot of the people you're referencing in that's like that opinion of like my club's better than your club or whatever. I've always been quite open about United being kind of shit. So, or at least for the past 10 years. But yeah, I think maybe it could be a blessing in disguise that this is an absolutely catastrophic season where United's issues are absolutely laid bare more so than ever before. Like the whole midfield issue. Like everything about the season. There's very, very little redeeming features about this season. Apart from maybe like Kobbie Mainoo breaking into the team, Garnacho kind of being more established. There is very, very little to look back at the season and say, you know what, that was at least a positive. Unless, you know, obviously Ten Hag will probably get sacked, which hopefully in future will be looked at as a positive. But I just don't, I have nowhere else to go. I have nowhere further south to go with this team. They are a lot worse than they were last year. There's about 4 players in that squad that it's worth building around. The rest are fully replaceable. Would recommend replacing them. The manager time is up. The squad has regressed. Like, we have the 6th worst actually diff per 90 in the league this season. Let that sink in. Like, United are across 35
games. The sixth worst. So there'll be the 3 teams going down, and then there are 2 more teams in the Premier League, and then you.
Yeah, and one of those teams going down is Sheffield United, by the way, who have, what, like 16 points?
Sure.
Like,
God, that's so insane.
So kind of across all of our podcasts, XG diff per 90 is the one metric that we use as a very simple way just to tell how good a team is, roughly. Just to gauge roughly where it is. It puts United in the bottom quarter. Bottom third.
So I assume it's the bottom three, and then like maybe Forest and Wolves, I'm guessing.
I can't remember. I need to get up here. But yeah, it's whichever way it is.
Jesus. For all that people are like, oh, we actually can't spend as much money as people think. Like, you did spend 70 mil on a striker in the summer.
Yeah, and we spent 100 million pounds on Anthony and 50 million pounds on Lisandro Martinez.
And you had injury problems, but like Spurs, Newcastle, Liverpool, they've all had injury problems. And I think they've all played to a higher standard. Jesus.
So the teams, oh, actually it's interesting. The two teams outside of the bottom three relegation zone that have a worse XG diff per 90 than United are Wolves and West Ham.
Oh yeah, West Ham were really, really low by this.
Yeah. But anyway, cut it. Horrible season. Burn it all. Save about three players. Sack. And also, but this is also the problem, right? Another problem as well. Obviously, Ten Hag has been tipped to be sacked. He's got very difficult four games remaining. I imagine it'll happen in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And the names being touted about are, let's say, a little bit hit and miss. Because
what are you talking about?
Well, the front runner is Thomas Tuchel.
The saviour of England, though?
The front runner is Thomas Tuchel. Which I like. I'm fine with that.
I don't think he's good enough. I think you need somebody, with like international pedigree.
Yeah. Has a famously good tailor as well.
Has worked with Rashford before.
Mm, yeah. Could maybe get Sancho back on side.
Exactly. Got the best out of all these guys. Harry Maguire, big fan. Get some value for money there.
Such a big fan that he refused to drop him, even though he barely played for United at that stage.
Yeah.
So
rightly so.
Outside of Thomas Tuchel, the next two highest linked in terms of like shortest odds are Graham Potter, whom we have been not very complimentary about on this podcast since its inception. I think our first episode was 40 minutes of battering how shit he'll be, or at least for me anyway. And the other one is Gareth fucking Southgate.
Like, slam dunk.
United, Old Trafford's falling down in more ways than one, figuratively and literally. How do you think bringing either of Graham Potter or Gareth Southgate in will be like the saviour? Nonsense. And it would be a very, very post-Ferguson United thing to have either one of those at the touchline at the start of next season.
Did you like these stories?
You know what, Patrick? That actually might be what tips me over the edge.
That could be it. I think if United sack Ten Hag and hire Southgate, I think this is the rare situation where you should get a bye, you know, as in we should say you are allowed to change club under these very specific circumstances. Yeah. I don't know why I've decided on this hypothetical, but I guess I was thinking about it because Mourinho has very, very clearly been trying to get a job through the press. Like, did you read the stories that was like, Jose Mourinho would be quite interesting going back to Man United? And I was like, oh, yeah, I wonder who's reporting this. Close friends of Jose Mourinho. Yeah, sure. But there were rumours at one stage this season that Newcastle might move on from Edward Howe.
Mm-hmm.
What would you think of Eddie Howe for United? I hate it
way less than Potter or Southgate, but I think I would prefer Tuchel. Tuchel over Howe, based on where United are. The good thing about Howe, I suppose the same with Tuchel, is that they'll come in and they'll have to know they're a cog in a bigger system now, because the issues that United are in is because managers have come in for two seasons and done what they wanted and then left.
Then
the next manager's come in and been like, well, this isn't what I want, so I'm going to buy players that I want. And then you left with this absolute mishmash of players. I would take either of them over the other two, over Potter or Southgate. I wouldn't hate it. I wouldn't be thrilled. But also at the same time, United have gone out and gotten some very big managers placed like in the past few years. No, actually, I suppose only Mourinho, really. Yeah. I wouldn't hate somebody coming in thinking like, this is a big step up, but also I have proven ability in the Premier League. I would have more faith in knowing that Howe would be able to be, at worst, completely competent.
Yeah. I do think that like competent with an idea of how they want to play is kind of an okay like situation for United.
Completely.
Going forward, like if it's coupled with just like sensible recruitment, you're such a rich club that should be enough to kind of get going. But
we just need to stop making bad decisions. We don't need to make good decisions. We just need to make less bad decisions, and we'll be okay.
And that's the thing. Like as a rival fan, you know, all season I've kind of wanted United to do just well enough that Ten Hag kept his job.
Just muddles along to kick the can down the road.
Yeah, because I was just like, another year of this would be fucking great. Like, I don't need United actually getting competent. Like, that would be annoying. You guys just need to kind of, like, keep trucking along, being, like, crap, but not, like, so crap that something has to be done. Whereas a United that goes and gets hold of Thomas Tuchel and, like, a bunch of sort of 20 to 24-year-olds, that is a bit of a threat. You know, not immediately, but certainly in 3 years.
That's why I think this United team are probably the worst United team in Premier League history, because there may have been worse teams individually in, like, I don't know, a post-Moyes era. But you look at those squads and they might be shit. Like, it might have Thomas Cleverley and fucking Fellaini in them. But you look at those squads and you're like, I kind of get what this squad is. I kind of get how you play with this setup. It's not good, but I kind of understand what the game plan is under the managers, under whatever manager was there at that point. You look at Ten Hag and the way he's meant to play. I'm still yet to see Ten Hag ball 2 years in. But you also look at his squad and you're like, what are these? These are just different components of different squads put together in one group. This isn't a squad. Mm. This isn't cohesive. There is no discernible structure or style that you can that I can look at this squad and these players and their like kind of play type and say, okay, this is how this team's going to play. There is none of that. It's just a complete mismatch of players with a manager that is completely unable to implement any form of like style. And it's very, very evident.
Yeah. And even the players that are good are kind of like accidental. Like, well, Garnacho.
Uncovered a diamond randomly.
Yeah, Garnacho just like kind of came out of nowhere. Hoyland's been good, but he's like, I know he was one for the future, but he did pay like 70 mil for him. He hasn't been like 70 mil good. He's just like promising and good.
It's very, very classic United to pay like finished product price for a future prospect talent.
Yeah. But I mean, I agree with all of this. Like, United are a mess, and the sooner the end of the season comes for United and they can start planning, the better.
So what I learned
even,
is...
Look, Southgate's bad, but even if Southgate came in and you signed some decent players, like, I do think that there's a path to being better there, but you are dreadful.
Southgate's bad, no fucking way. Oh,
he is bad.
So what I learned this season was that there's absolutely nothing positive about United right now, for the first time. I have zero positive caveats to add.
I really enjoy it.
I can imagine. Okay, what did you learn this season, Patrick?
Reluctantly, Klopp's work at Liverpool deserved more trophies. I think Klopp's work at Liverpool has an outsized influence given the trophies they won. Like, obviously they've won like basically every club trophy that there is. And also they've had a weekend of the season. They went out of the Europa League to Atalanta. They were top at the beginning of April, then they went 2-2-2. Over a run that should have been kind of relatively easy. They lost to Palace, they lost to Everton, they drew with United, they drew with West Ham. But they were the better team by XG in all of those games, but bar the Everton game and kind of the Fulham game. but you know, like they maybe deserve better from that run. And while I don't think they deserve better than finishing third, like I did say in January, the probability is that they will not win the league. I obviously changed my mind recently because they were top and they were winning and they had an easy run. But like in January, we were kind of like, City are better, Arsenal are better. However, the fact that they kind of stayed the course with them until nearly the end of the season with the best Arsenal team in 20 years and an Arsenal team that could still end on 89 points and with Pep's Man City, who could easily end on over 90 points. They stayed with them until nearly the end of the season.
Longer than Arsenal did last year.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable stuff. And look, I do think the injury stuff is a bit overblown. I was looking at their numbers today and like 8 of their team have over 2,000 minutes, which is the same as Arsenal. And I was going down the names in the squad list, you know, like by ranking them by minutes played. And I got to the 18th, who was Kwanzaa, before I was like, yeah, that's someone that you don't really want to use too much.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, everyone above that is like fine. Like like the kind of lowest profile guys above that are like Harvey Elliott or Curtis Jones. And I was like, these are first team quality Premier League players. Like, I mean, this is not bad at all. So I wasn't like...
Yeah, so literally, you've got a roster of a full 11 plus 5 subs every...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I was just like, my sympathy is a little bit limited. And especially because, as I said just now,
every
you know,
other
like...
team has injuries.
Newcastle, Spurs, like a bunch of teams. Like Arsenal, we're talking about having had like an amazing season injury-wise. And Arsenal had like Timber ruled out in the first game of the season, missed a midfielder we don't like to talk about for like half the season, missed Gabi Jesus for long stretches. Like, and they've had a really fortunate season with injuries, I would say. So there's that side of it. However, they have still played those kids quite a bit. Like Kwanzaa's got 1,000 minutes. Bradley has got about 9 full 90s so far. And that's proper game time. And
yeah, that's quite long.
And it wasn't like a couple of guys were out for the whole season in Liverpool's case, and you just have to adapt to it. You know, you plug another guy in and you figure it out. Basically, all their starters, or the majority of their starters, have missed at least a portion of the season. And yet, they've still got the best attack in the league by expected goals. They're a little bit unlucky. The gap between them and City in attacking XG numbers is bigger than the gap between City and Newcastle. So City are the second best, Newcastle are the fourth best, Arsenal are third. The gap between Liverpool in first and City in second is bigger than the gap between City in second and Newcastle in fourth. So they're significantly the best attacking team in the league. And the defence is not amazing, but it's fine. It's not like Spurs or Man United level. It's like, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done it while completely changing style. You know, like we talked about them being more direct this season. I think that was really, really smart. I think they've changed up style so many times under Klopp. You know, like there was a point where the midfield did nothing. When they had Fabinho, Wijnaldum and Henderson, Nobody in that midfield did a fucking thing. Like that midfield just sat there and stopped you passing through particular lanes in the middle of the park. That was all they did. But they didn't really do any build up and everything went through the fullbacks. And then this season, you look at them and you're like, right, Trent and Robertson are out. And the midfield is like a whole new look midfield. What are they going to do? And they just played a more direct style. They just did it. It was remarkable. They're still the second hardest pressing side in the league to Spurs, but their press is so much more effective than Spurs's, I think. And I just look at that and I think, if you give Klopp some players, he will work something out, you know? And not only did he work something out to make Liverpool look competent, he worked something out that could easily have won them the title this season.
Yeah, yeah.
If they had had slightly fewer injuries, maybe they'd have done it. I mean, you can always say that, I guess, about a team that doesn't win the title. But that's insane that he put them in a position where they could have won the title. And I don't think they didn't win the title because of Klopp. Like, maybe they didn't win the Europa League because of Klopp, but like the title, I don't think he got his tactics like significantly wrong in loads of games. And across his whole time, they made three Champions League finals, should probably have won two. They should have won that last one against Real Madrid, where they just played really badly and Real Madrid played really well. They've gone toe to toe this entire time with a team which has broken the rules, objectively has broken the rules, in a dozen different ways.
Mm.
Like, we all argue about the charges against Man City, but we do all know that they fucking make up the numbers that they are, you know, of their sponsors. We do know that there is, like, money being shuffled around with image rights and all this shit. Like, we all know that this happens. Like, this is just a truth universally acknowledged.
I saw a graph yesterday that said that Manchester City are the second highest revenue-earning football club in the world.
Yeah, because they're so fucking popular.
Course. Just behind Real Madrid. Because, more than Barcelona, more than Manchester United. Mental.
When I was,
more
than I don't know about you, but when I was a kid and I went on holiday, I would see, you know, like, I would see Brazilian Ronaldo shirts, I'd see Luis Figo shirts, I'd see fucking Paul Dickov shirts. That's what I'd see.
Yeah.
Like, it's just ridiculous. Like, this kind of stuff is nonsense. But Liverpool went toe-to-toe with them and played amazing, distinctive football, battered them a couple of times in huge matches. Were, I'd say, probably the most entertaining side in the world for a really good portion of Klopp's time there. And he's re-established Liverpool as one of the best teams in the world. Like, they hadn't won a title in 30 years. Now you've got to take Liverpool seriously. Whoever inherits this team has got a good young squad, and they don't just inherit that. They also inherit an identity and a fear factor. You know, like, Anfield is so much scarier now than it was 10 years ago. Really is. And they also know how these players want to play, and they know the level that these players can reach. So I just think it's like a phenomenal managerial reign. And when I look at it and I'm like, wow, one Champions League, one title, I think that really does misrepresent how good it's been. Because in my opinion, only Pep, Wenger and Ferguson are better Premier League managers than Klopp.
I think that's completely fair.
Like, but that's amazing company to be in. Like, it really is. I mean, it really is amazing company. I'm putting him ahead of Mourinho there.
I agree with him being ahead of Mourinho. I think I pitched something to you like middle of last season in my anti-Liverpool slander that I tried to make an argument that Klopp's time at Liverpool was a failure. Mm-hmm. And I still think you can make that argument, but the argument's solely based on the fact that after creating such a immense team, one of the best squads and runs in the Premier League that the Premier League has ever seen, he'll leave with only one title and one Champions League. Like, that team deserved way more.
You can't be a failure, though, if you win a first title in 30 years.
I know. And I was, like, really trying to slander Klopp. No, like, That team should have won significantly more than they did. And the only problem is that they've existed at the same time as probably the best team in the Premier League history, at least best squad across a number of seasons. Whether, you know, legality of that aside, it's just unfortunate. Like, I think they amassed 198 points across two seasons and still didn't win one of those leagues.
But even if they just had slightly better luck some of the time, you know, so like Simeone has been there longer, but over the last 10 years, Simeone has won more titles with Atletico Madrid than Liverpool have won under Klopp. Like, he's won two titles in that time with Atleti, despite having, you know, like two kind of like mega clubs to compete with. Well, it's kind of insane that Liverpool didn't get lucky one season, you know, like City didn't have like that one injury one season that just fucking killed them or something. And they didn't just win another title. Like, the only title they won was the COVID one.
Yeah.
And it just feels like that is a bit unlucky. But he is still, since he and Conte are the only people to take a Premier League title off Pep. And Conte did it in Pep's first season when, like, Pep ball was not rolling yet, right? Like, it was still a work in progress. Like, he didn't have his squad in place and there were a bunch of shit players. Like, Klopp is the only guy really seriously to take a title off Pep. I mean, maybe that would change at the end of the season, but probably not. I don't know. I just think it's like a remarkable managerial performance. And he is quite an annoying man, and he's got steadily more annoying over his time at Liverpool. But he really is amazing. And I don't know. I just think that, like, when people look back in 20 years, they'll be like, well, they won one title, and they won't really think that, you know, like Leicester won a title. Like, like it won't look as serious an achievement as it is, but it is a fucking colossal achievement, I think. Winning a title against Pep City, I think, is remarkable. And I just think, yeah, I'm glad he's going. That's really the highest compliment I can pay. Like, I'm fucking glad that Liverpool will not be managed by Jurgen Klopp next season, because he's incredible.
Fair.
Yeah. What have you got next?
The next thing I learned this season is, it's a bit rogue, I'm not going to lie. I think you might have to hear me out a little bit. But this season, I now think that Ancelotti is the best manager since Sir Alex Ferguson retired. So basically what I'm saying there is
he's better than Ferguson. What do you mean?
I knew you were going to say that. Basically, distilling that down is that I think that I'm starting to think that Ancelotti is better than Pep.
That is such a...
And I don't even know if I believe this truly myself, but...
That's such a sort of Mundial magazine take. You know?
Right, okay. So basically, my prep for this section is basically just an unedited stream of consciousness and deep thinking on my part. But basically, right, Pep is obviously like the managerial golden boy. Like, everybody absolutely rims him. And I think that's fair enough. He is... undoubtedly phenomenal manager, only manager to win two trebles, etc. You know, he is incredible. He is.
Is he?
He's pretty good. But I think Ancelotti might be better. Like, CV alone, Ancelotti's is at least comparable. Most Champions Leagues in history. He's going to add another one. Surely he has to add another one in a few weeks.
It'll be funny if he doesn't.
This section would take a hit if he doesn't. But yeah, Madrid against Dortmund, that has to only go one way. Only manager to win the league in all five European top leagues. So I think, like, at worst, their CVs are comparable. But I think Pep gets way more respect than Ancelotti does. Everybody says Pep is, like, this incredible tactical manager, and I think there is a lot of truth in that. But I also feel that Pep has kind of inherited either some of the greatest players to ever play the game or some of the most stacked squads ever, or essentially a blank checkbook from a state nation. So...
Whereas as opposed to Ancelotti, who's obviously, you know, managing some tin pot Spanish side.
Obviously he is not managing tin pot teams, but I feel that, okay, so they both managed Bayern, and I kind of don't really care about their time at Bayern.
Though I think Ancelotti's time at Bayern, I think Ancelotti's time at Bayern underrated, you know?
Fair. And then Pep went to Barca with Messi, Iniesta, Xavi. Then he went to Man City with infinite resources, and even though he did have things to tweak in his first season there, there were, like, a lot of building blocks there. KDB was already there. And I just feel that Pep has kind of come into teams that are already in third and fourth gear and not had to be hugely inventive to get the best out of them. I think he's amazing at developing young players and moulding players, and, like, his tactical setup and in-game tweaks are amazing. But I feel like it's quite a bit easier when you've got a Lionel Messi in your team, or you've got...
Agreed.
Essentially a blank check, but go out and say, we have this hole to fill. Let's go and get the best possible player to fill that hole. And With Ancelotti, obviously he has inherited some amazing squads. He's had some stacked squads over his time. He has managed the biggest clubs in the world. But I feel that he's been more, or had to be more inventive throughout his entire career to get the success he's had. You know, he created space for Zidane to be a floating CAM at Juve. He used Pirlo as a deep-lying playmaker and won two Champions Leagues with Inter. He used Di Maria as a box-to-box midfielder to try and create some more balance when Bale, Benzema and Cristiano did like whatever the fuck they wanted to do. And more recently, he used Bellingham as a 10 instead of a 6 and 8, which we all thought...
I think you mean Milan rather than Inter. He did not win Champions League.
I mean, AC Milan, yes.
Yeah.
I wrote down Inter, yes. I meant AC Milan. More recently, he has used Bellingham as a 10, which has been incredible this season. But whenever he was purchased, everybody thought he's going to be a 6 or he's going to be an 8. He's also used Camavinga at left back at points. And he's probably going to do the double this season with Hossolu as their only recognised centre forward. I feel sick. Like the uphill battle or the shit that Ancelotti's had to work out is substantially more difficult than what Pep has had to work out. And obviously Pep's amazing. It sounds like I'm like pissing all over Pep's cornflakes. And I'm not. Like I'm a little bit like, fuck Pep.
Yeah, you are.
But what Pep has done is amazing. And he is will undoubtedly go down as one of the greatest managers of all time. And I might still think he's better than Ancelotti. I'm really not sure. But this season, I'm just starting to believe that Ancelotti might be better than Pep. I might rate Ancelotti higher. Okay, that might be the difference, okay? Whether Ancelotti's better or not is not what I'm speaking about. I'm actually speaking about who I rate the most. And I think I rate Ancelotti higher because I feel he's done more with less. Or he's done a comparable amount with less. And
there's also just something about him that like...
He's just a fucking Don. He is the Don.
There's something more romantic about it as well. Like, I mean, like when you watch Pep, you're just like, yes, like... You trained like an AI model to score more goals than the opposition. Whereas with Carlo, I was just like, there's something lovable about it.
Yeah.
You know, like in the second poetic. Half against Bayern, he was like, I've had this amazing idea. And rather than asking Vinicius Jr. to come inside, we're actually going to tell him to play on the left wing.
Yeah.
And to take on his man. This is a brainwave I've had. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, it's always something like that with Ancelotti, where you're like, yeah, that's a really obvious thing that you should do. But he does it at the right time and it works. And then his team wins. And you're like, if you do the right thing enough times, then you are a great manager. Like in the same way that if you do the right thing most of the time, you're a great central midfielder. Mm-hmm. You know, like Ancelotti doesn't do stupid cowboy shit. Yeah. And I also think, okay, and I know that like non-Premier League fans will kind of be annoyed by this, but I do think that his image is enhanced a little bit by that period at Everton. Because that period at Everton, it was just like, that's pure like managerial skill. Like, what can you do with this crap side? And
the fact that he got him is insane.
I know, before he went back to Real Madrid. But like, he did a great job. They were genuinely good under him. And then he left and they were an absolute disaster basket case.
Almost got relegated.
And I was just like, I mean, for the people who are like, Carlo doesn't do tactics, like riddle me that one. Like that's quite an impressive feat, I thought. And then he went back to Real Madrid and he was like, oh God, I've got a load of shit here. What can I cobble together? Won the Champions League immediately.
And I think like a lot of people do him a disservice by saying he's not like an overly tactical manager, because I think it's quite easy to see Pep as a tactical manager because you see him on the sideline. He basically creates these boring formulaic squads who all do the same thing. Everybody has this, when you're in a certain position, doesn't matter who you are, this is what Pep wants you to do. And he'll be shouting at you to move 1 yard left for 90 minutes. Whereas Ancelotti, you know, Bellingham actually said, I think, after the game that one of the greatest things about this current setup at Real Madrid for him is that he allows the players to play with freedom. Like, he builds systems that allows the players within them to play with freedom. And I think that's far more difficult to mitigate for tactically and be successful with than it is than Pep just being like, this is my model. You need to fit in to do exactly what I want you to do. And I think Ancelotti, because he's a lot more quiet, he's a lot quieter on the touchline. He's kind of more calm. He's less like, I suppose, I always hate the videos you see after like City have won the FA Cup, and then like he cuts to an image of Pep like screaming at Jack Grealish on the pitch about whatever tactic, and everyone's like,
and they're like, wow, he demands perfection, and you're like, no, he's just being a twat.
He's just been a cunt. Like, he's just fucking won the FA Cup, like, celebrate. You don't ever see that with Ancelotti, and I think that kind of takes away for a lot of people, leads them to believe that he's not as tactically astute as Pep, and he might not be as tactically astute, but I don't think he's as far off as a lot of people think he is. Like, you do not get five Champions League, well, four. No, sorry, five. No, he's got four now. He should have five. You do not get that without having very good tactical ability as a manager. And yeah, like, he's just so much more likable. He creates more likable teams. He lets players play with freedom. He is just a really intelligent manager. And that picture you retweeted of him after they won the Champions League, after they won the La Liga, is one of my favorite pictures this season, because not only does it slap, like him in sunglasses with a cigar, he's also wearing a sweater vest, which is very grandpa core, which, as we all know, is a big trend for 2024.
Mm-hmm. As we learn here on the podcast.
Yeah. So I don't know if I think he's better than Pep, but I don't not know it. And I definitely rate him more than Pep.
It's not a ridiculous claim. And certainly when you stack up their achievements at the end of their careers, like, we will be able to say, oh, but the thing about Pep is just, like, he created these incredible tactical systems, like, you could not stop his team scoring, blah blah blah. But, like, how do we prove that he was better than Ancelotti? I don't know if you can. I literally don't know if you can. With Ancelotti, you're like, he's just done it everywhere. He has done it everywhere.
He stays there for 2 years and will win the league and maybe a Champions League, and then he'll move on to a different club.
And I love him. He's the best. He's the coolest man. He probably is the coolest guy in football. I can't think of anyone who's cooler than him.
Xabi Alonso's pretty cool.
No, he's not.
Xabi Alonso's pretty cool.
What, in his fucking, like, V-neck merino wool jumper?
I mean,
he's a hot boy.
He's a hot boy.
You know that he's going to talk to you about, like, cover shadows and, like, rest defences and stuff. Shut up, bro. He's like Arteta. Like, he's not cool. He's way
hotter than Arteta.
He's hotter than Arteta, but I reckon he's about as uncool as Arteta is. And in my opinion, Arteta is super uncool.
Right.
Ancelotti, coolest man in football. I like it, you know. I would say that there are lots of managers since Ferguson who are better than Ferguson. You know, so the question is Ancelotti the best manager since Wenger, you know, for example?
Okay, sure.
No, I just can't even keep it together.
So I think we...
Fuck. Okay, right.
We should avoid that.
All right. I got a quick one. We may be entering another golden age for Premier League strikers.
Mm-hmm.
So, fair. I think that there's always... pundits have always got some line about what you have to do to, you know, win the Premier League. So they'll be like, oh, to win the Premier League, you need a 20-goal-a-season striker. That was the case for years. They said that for years. Total bullshit. And then it was, oh, you need goals from midfield. If you don't get goals from midfield, like, how are you ever going to win the title? By having a 20-goal-a-season striker? Like, there are lots of ways. Like, this is this thing where, like, there's always this kind of argument. But it does feel at the moment, like, weirdly, after the kind of death of the striker, which was something we were talking about in the mid-2010s, it swung back towards, no, it's really good to have a guy who scores 20 goals a season in your team.
Yeah.
There are currently three Premier League players with over 20 league goals, which is kind of crazy. And another three or four could quite realistically join them by the end of the season. You know, there are guys who are very close, like Salah and Solanke are both on 18. Son is on 17. There are a bunch of guys on 16, but it's quite unlikely somebody on 16 with two games left is going to make it to 20.
So but you could easily get like six players.
You could end up with just the three we've got. But even if you ended up with just the three we've got, there are players like Salah and Solanke who have over 20 XG, but haven't scored 20. So nonetheless, I still think there's enough to see a trend here. And you actually haven't had five players score 20 goals in a season since 16-17. That's the only time since 2010 that more than four players have got 20 goals in a Premier League season. So it's actually really rare to have lots of players hit that mark. And this season, there are so many guys who could hit that mark. And again, you know, what shows that it's not necessarily like this wins you the title. Two of the teams in the title race don't have someone on 20. Arsenal are going to end without somebody on 20 unless Saka has an insane last two games. But Villa, Newcastle, Chelsea, maybe even Bournemouth all do have somebody on 20 or will end up with somebody on 20 probably. So I don't think it's necessarily a predictor of success, but I do think it says something about the attacking talent that we have in the league right now. because you've got a bunch of established guys like Haaland, he's got 25, Watkins, who's got, I think he's still on 19, Bowen's got 16, Solanke is on 18. Those guys aren't going anywhere, as in, you know, Solanke could move clubs, but like those guys are going to stay in the Premier League. And then you've got 24-year-olds like Alexander Isak and Nunez, who are up around that mark. Nunez has like 18 XG or something. You've got 23-year-old Foden, who's got 16 goals. You've got Jackson, who, okay, has I think 13, but he's on 18 XG. And he's actually fourth in the Premier League for expected goals plus assists per 90 minutes. Fourth. Saka is 22. Cole Palmer is 22. Like, there are a bunch of guys there. Son could stay another year and have another big year. Salah could feasibly stay, probably won't, but still. So it's not hard to imagine that next year there are 6 to 8 guys, even Tony could stick around. He's hit 20 before. Like, there could be 6 to 8, maybe even as many as 10 people who have a relatively realistic hope that they could get 20 goals in the league.
Yeah.
Which is nuts. And another thing about it, and, you know, it's really an observation. Like, I don't have like a big, you know, argument here about the way tactics are going, but I just think it's interesting. There are 5 players in the league this season with over 1,000 minutes and over 4 shots a game. And there are 28 players with over 3 shots per 90. I looked 3 years ago, there was only one guy with over 4 shots per 90, and that was Harry Kane, and there were only 15 with over 3. So the number of players who are like shot monsters in the Premier League has doubled in the last 3 years, and goals have been ticking up too, goals per game. So 3 years ago, there were 2.7 goals per Premier League game. Then it was 2.8 the year after, then it was 2.9. This year we're at 3.3, which is crazy. So it just feels like, I don't know what it means, but it's provocative.
Sure.
I was just like, it's interesting to me. It's interesting to me. And after a long time where we were like, strikers are kind of done, you know, and like teams share it around. No, now there are a bunch of strikers who are like going to score 20 league goals in a season. And genuinely, in 3 years' time, if I was just like Isak, Nunez, Jackson, one of Saka, Palmer, Foden, Haaland, Watkins, all of those guys could be hitting 20 league goals. It would not be crazy.
Rasmus Højlund, at all. Of course.
I don't know who that is. like, it's completely plausible that that could be the case. And I just think that's really fascinating because there was a long period in the late 2010s where, you know, we had like Aubameyang and Mane and people like being top scorer in the league with like 22 goals, 23 goals in the league. And now we're back again where you've got like one guy who's like a fucking supernova in Haaland who could get 30 goals again this season. He could easily get like another 5 in his remaining 3 games. And a bunch of people who have hopes of 2025. So I don't know. I just found it very, very interesting after the last couple of seasons we've had with Arsenal sharing it around last season and again this season, City sharing it around the season before. I thought it was an interesting thing to note. What's your last one?
So, looking at the script that we compiled, I think our last ones are kind of similar. So my last one is that I was wrong to write off City graduates, most significantly Cole Palmer. Because I don't know if you remember at the start of the season, or in the summer, I think I had Cole Palmer down as potentially the second worst signing of that window for £40 million points. I think the worst being Brennan Johnson, which, you know, I'm still fine with that one. But I was incredibly wrong to write off Cole Palmer because basically when it happened, I was like £40 million for a guy who's like 22 and can't get into the City team. And to be fair, not being able to get into the City team does not mean you're a bad player. Like, there are many good players who have come to City and just been like, Pep doesn't fancy me enough to trust me to be a star. Like, it's so difficult to hold down a starting position in a Pep team, certainly over a number of seasons. But going to Chelsea felt like Palmer was bench fodder going to a club that was already full of bench fodder for £40 million quid. And I was like, there is no substance here to this transfer. This is mental. But I think everybody would agree with me in saying that I was catastrophically wrong in this regard, because he is genuinely very good. And I mean,
he is good.
Very, very good. He obviously, like, you can use his top line stats, 30 goal involvements in 26 Premier League 90s this season, which is incredible. And even if you take out the 9 penalties, that's still 21 goal involvements in 26 Premier League 90s for a guy who I thought was going to be like add virtually nothing, maybe sub minutes. The fact that he's got 30 goal involvements this season is quite significant because he's only the third player since the turn of the century to do that, age 22 or younger. And the other two were Ronaldo in his Ballon d'Or winning season and Erling Haaland in his record-breaking 36-goal season last season. So he is up within the most rarefied of airs in that regard. And okay, sure, the caveat is there is a lot of penalties in that, but his numbers are still amazing even if you take out the penalties. So he's top 4% in the league for non-penalty XG and assists. He's top 10% for non-penalty goals, top 10% for non-penalty XG. He's completing nearly 7 progressive passes per 90, top 3%. Like, he is chipping in all over the pitch, and top 10% for carries as well, 5th in the league for live ball passes that result in a shot attempt per 90. He is basically everything good Chelsea are doing going forward. Cole Palmer is an integral cog in it, and that is by far and away significantly more influence than I thought he would ever have at Chelsea. Even if it took him like 2 or 3 years to get up to speed till we saw like Cole Palmer peak, I still thought he would be, at best, a pretty reliable starter, if not squad player. But this season has been staggering. So, what I learned was to not write off City Academy products, because I also kind of did it with Foden a few years ago as well. I didn't write him off. It wasn't in the same way. I knew Foden was good. I just didn't subscribe to the rim him as much as everybody did. I didn't subscribe to the fact that he was
like,
so good.
I did that too. I did that too, and everyone like kind of gave me shit when he turned out to be good, and I was just like, I never said he wasn't going to be good.
I just didn't see enough of it.
What I said was that at the time, everyone was like, he's incredible, and I was like, he's got like 1,200 minutes in the league. Like, and they're like, oh, well, Pep said he's one of the best players in the world. It's just like, okay. Like,
if he's one of the best players in the world, then play him more. See, that was my big problem with Foden. And
Pep says many things.
Yeah.
As I think Messi once said when somebody asked him about Pelé. Pelé had said some shit about Messi, and they said, what do you think about what Pelé said? And Messi said, Pelé says many things. And that was it. That was his response. And I was like, rinsed. Like, you can't argue with that. Like, Pelé does say a bunch of horseshit.
Well, not anymore.
Doesn't say much now, does he? Is that your point? Wow.
But yeah, so I've been burned by, underrating or being too harsh on City graduates before. And look, the City Academy does seem great. Working closely with Pep at young age does seem to turn very high prospects into very, very good players at a pretty respectable, if not very impressive, rate. So what I learned was, don't underestimate City's products, because even if they don't want them, they can be very, very useful to another top team.
And I think, you're right, this does dovetail with what I was going to say. Because my point was like, one man's trash is another man's treasure. Like, I do just think like we generally write off players and managers too quickly. And I know that like, I'm a culprit for that. Though at the same time, it is a bit difficult when your job entails having football takes. Yeah. It is easier when you don't have to do that for a living. But I do think that football at the moment, especially, is demonstrating that success is as much about landing in the right place as it is about your like raw talent. If Palmer had landed at another club where there'd been somebody ahead of him in the pecking order, like say he'd ended up at like Arsenal and was like trying to dislodge Saka. Mm-hmm. Even if he'd been like better than Saka in training, he probably would have had to be a lot better than Saka in training for like Arteta to drop Saka, because Saka's so important. Like, if there'd been somebody ahead of him in the pecking order at the club he'd arrived at, it would have been much harder for him to get starts, much harder for him to get momentum. You know, if he hadn't been taking penalties even, we would still be talking about him as great, but we would probably not have as much focus on him as we do currently. Yeah. Like, but I think this goes for lots of players. You know, like, obviously, yeah, if you want to talk about City graduates, like Jeremy Frimpong, like winning the Bundesliga with Leverkusen this season. Jadon Sancho.
Yeah.
Like, Jadon Sancho and Ian Mattson, by the way, leaving Europa League, Conference League level sides, Chelsea and Man United, and now both in the Champions League final. And they're joined there by Joselu.
Well, yeah, he's a fantastic example of just finding the right player. He was like, everybody the other night or last night was talking about how, like, the bloke from Stoke is now obviously he played a big part in last night, the comeback win in the second leg of the semi-final, which everybody will remember and will talk about. But he's actually been super important for Real Madrid across the entire season. Mm. And this is a guy who could you argue he failed at Stoke?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you could argue that Solanke failed at Liverpool. Look at him now.
Yeah.
I think that somebody like Darmian, Mkhitaryan, Benjamin Pavard, all at Inter Milan, all got 2,000 minutes this season. I think maybe one's sort of 1500, but I think no. And I think Inter Milan are the best Italian side we've seen in 6-7 years. Mm. Eric Dier, we all laughed at Bayern signing Eric Dier. I think he's totally justified to signing him. Like, he's been completely fine. Like, he hasn't been bad at all. Like, is he amazing on the ball? No. Is he the best defender in the world in space? No. Has he been good enough for them to potentially have won a Champions League? Yeah. They didn't not get to the Champions League final because of Eric Dier. Even managerially, you know, obviously Unai Emery doing a good job at Villa. Gary O'Neill, I think, is doing a better job at Wolves than I thought he did at Bournemouth. So I think that, like, we used to never analyze football at all. Like, when I know I bang on about this, but like, it is really crazy that when I started at FD, people didn't even really talk about assists. And certainly they didn't talk about shots and key passes. And I remember having to like explain those things in scripts and even talk to guys in the office and like argue the point. I was like, this is why I think it matters. And like, it was really something that I was like quite passionate about. But back then, there was almost no analysis. Now, you can find like reams of analysis where people are like, oh, this player like is amazing at like, you know, using his cover shadow, or like, oh, this manager like structures his rest defense so well, and all this kind of shit. And like, I'm not saying it's all shit, like there's value in a lot of it. But also, a lot of it is just, does the right player land at the right club with the right coach? Are they used the right way? And when they are, it's amazing who can turn out to be useful. And when they don't land in the right place, it's amazing who can turn out to be kind of worthless. And I don't know, like, I just think it'd be nice to withhold judgment a little bit more. I would like to do that, but probably next week I'll be like, so-and-so, he's fucking shit.
But like you say, it is quite difficult when you're in this scenario where you literally need to do it for a job or whatever, some form of like media outlet, because you're put in a position where you have to do and give your opinions on certain things. Whereas if you weren't, you would probably still have the same opinions, just they wouldn't be broadcast or recorded. And people wouldn't like be able to clap back at you with them in 3 months' time when whatever you predicted is completely wrong.
Yeah. Fortunately, one of the ways that I deal with that is by just like not respecting anyone else's opinion, Pete. Like, when people say stuff to me on Twitter, they're just like, oh my God, this guy's like absolutely cooked you. I'm just like,
cool.
It's not going to stop my daughters loving me. Like, shut up. You don't interest me. You don't. The world will spin on, like, with you not thinking that I'm good at football takes.
Yeah. One of the most liberating things I've ever done in my life is realize that I don't give a fuck about what a lot of random people think about me.
Yeah, but that must have been like 25 minutes after you were born. Like, I imagine that they were just like, oh, you know, like, we're not sure about his colour or whatever. And you were just like, oh, this person's a fucking prick, you know? Oh, he... <We're>... Oh, my God.
It looked like you were holding back from saying something there, like something popped
in
your head.
Yeah, I did a bit. I did a bit, but I think it was it's in the interest of, like, you know, this podcast, us one day getting brevity. A sponsor on this podcast.
Fair
Speaking
enough.
Of which, if you work with a company that would like to sponsor our podcast, why don't we have a sponsor, Pete? That feels like something you could do. Can you drum up a sponsor using your contacts?
Just procure a sponsorship.
Using your charm?
Would Tato
sponsor us?
I bought enough bags for the wedding, so hopefully I'm in good favour with Mr. Tato, which is the name of the...
Chad Tato. Chad Tato.
We could get a podcast. We could get a sponsor. I'm not sure how much value we would give the sponsor. I think we would cause more headaches than value.
I'm considerably less interested in that than like the value the sponsor would give me, so that I can buy Jawns online. Like that's what I want.
Sure, I can try.
Okay. Well, look. Let's open the bird book. Okay, it's burn book time. Pete, should we start with in or out?
Do you want me to go first?
Not necessarily, but sure.
I can start with... I'm going to start with out. I'm going to start on a positive this week.
Oh, okay.
Because what I'm taking out of the burn book this week, I think we mentioned it a few months ago, but what I'm taking out of the burn book this week is Biltong.
Ooh.
Because Biltong is fucking sick. So if you don't know what Biltong is, basically it is South African beef jerky. And... I think we've spoken about this before because you used to live beside a South African butcher's.
Yeah. And also, when I was a kid, my granny, when she would come over from South Africa, would bring biltong for me and my dad.
Sick. And so I think that might have planted like a seed in my brain. And obviously, I've had it before and know that I love it. but I hadn't had it in years. And then, do you ever have those moments where something just randomly pops into your head one like day, and it just consumes you? You just think about it for the entire day, and then like the day after it. And basically, I spent like 3 days thinking about biltong. I went online to like order biltong online and stuff, and I was like, oh, it's quite expensive. Bit of a faff. Like you have to
it is expensive.
You have to get quite a big order to get it sent to you. And I was like, I don't really want to spend like 50 quid on biltong. Especially if it's like something that I haven't had in years and it could be shit. Like I knew biltong was still good, but I don't know if this company is good.
Mm.
And then I remembered that there are quite a lot of South African like chain butchers in London, specifically around the train station. So I was like, I'll just pop into one of them. They have to have biltong. They must. So I did on my home from work one day. Got about £15 worth of biltong. And well, I just walked in and just like straight away, like at the butcher counter, it was just trays of biltong. All different like infusions.
Was it hanging from
flavors.
The ceiling?
No. It was pre-cut. So they had the stuff up on the ceiling, but like the stuff that was pre-prepared was just all pre-cut in like the metal trays behind the butcher, like the glass. And yeah, all infused with different flavors. And basically it was just like 100 grams of that, 100 grams of that, 100 grams of that. But you spent about 15 quid. And let me tell you, Patrick, it's as good as I remember. I got some standard biltong because I was like, I want a reference point. I want a ground zero. And then I got some chili, like chili chutney one. And then I got a peri peri one as well. And let me tell you, like they didn't fuck about with the spices either. Like when they said there's chili in it, like they're fairly punchy because you're only buying 100 grams for like a fiver. So it's not that much meat really, but you don't really need to eat that much. Mm. Of it, it's like I wouldn't sit down and eat like a full bag, 100 gram bag. I mean, maybe I would.
You could though.
You could. It depends on. Yeah, you could.
It's also, I would say, very similar in look and in texture to sweets. It's the Haribo of meat.
Oh, absolutely. Biltong. It's very, very Moorish in a similar way. And it was just a delightful experience that I'm still thinking about now going back. I'm trying to leave it a respectable enough time before I can go back and buy more, because I don't want to get in this stage where I'm feeding like a £15 a week biltong fix, because that's quite a slippery slope, and I don't really need to be spending £60 a month on cured dried meat. But would definitely recommend sourcing out some biltong if that tickles your fancy, because it is fucking great.
We should have had this conversation earlier in the year, because my parents were in Zimbabwe earlier in the year, and then they just got back from South Africa like this week.
Yeah. Did they bring you biltong?
I live near so many South African butchers, and everybody I bump into around here is South African.
I live near no South African butchers. It's fucking annoying. It's been fine up until the last 2 weeks when I was like, I really want biltong now. But yeah, I've had a. I think I finished the biltong last night, but I'm now trying to stop myself from going to buy more. I'll probably buy more next week.
Okay. I mean, it's a great one. I love biltong. It was a big part of my childhood. I actually, my out this week, I'm taking out of the burn book something almost identical to something you once took out of the burn book.
Okay.
Which is making wraps with shit from the air fryer.
Yes.
Yeah. So the other day.
Welcome, brother.
We were like, what are we going to have for supper? Fucking hell. What are we going to have? You know, the perennial question. What are we going to do?
Sure.
And then Emma was just like, we've got a halloumi in the fridge.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put it in the air fryer. And it was unbelievable. It was crisped on all sides.
Did you just do the block?
No. That'll be fucking... No, we're not fucking maniacs. Like, but we had it then in wraps with some candied jalapenos and like mayonnaise and lettuce and just like... And like a kind of cabbage slaw, you know, like red cabbage slaw that Emma made. It was fucking incredible. There's something about a wrap which is just so satisfying. Like it is one of the finest. I mean, it's like the sandwich's European cousin, you know?
It's way better than a sandwich.
Okay, let's pump the brakes there. Like, that's fucking crazy talk. It's a subcategory of sandwich. What the fuck are you talking about?
The burrito is the single most impressive invention of mankind. And that's
sure,
a big
wrap.
Sure,
but this doesn't... But that is a type of wrap, and a wrap is a type of sandwich.
Yeah, but a burrito, a wrap can be the best version of a sandwich.
It's not the best version of a sandwich. Best version of a sandwich is a fucking sandwich. But look, when you want a wrap, nothing else is going to do it for you. And so, like, we had that, and then the next day it was like, what are we going to have for supper? And it was like, should we get some chicken and make extremely similar wraps, except replacing the halloumi with chicken? And it's like a light meal, you know, because, like, there's the wrap, but otherwise what I'm having, like, at least with chicken, it's relatively light. I'm having chicken and, like, salad stuff and a little bit of mayonnaise in a wrap. Like, you feel great afterwards. And now every single day I'm just like, what can we fucking put in this air fryer?
Okay, can I recommend something for the chicken?
Okay.
So what I do is you get cornflakes and you crush them up into, like, sure, fine cornflake. You get some flour and you get an egg. Whisk the egg. I put some hot sauce in the egg as well. And then put some paprika and onion granules, garlic granules, and then spice it up how you would like. Spice the chicken and spice the cornflake mix. Flour, egg, cornflake mix in the air fryer. It's essentially fried chicken.
The first thing I made in our air fryer was something akin to that. I can't remember. It was a cereal stuff. I can't remember. I don't know if we had actual cornflakes, but I used something like...
Yeah.
I used crushed up crackers.
Ooh.
You know, like Ritz cracker type things.
Interesting.
As the breading. But I need to iterate. Like, it was okay.
Mm.
It was not incredible, in my opinion. But yeah, I think that now, like, basically every day, I just want to be like, what can I wrap?
Air fryer some wraps.
Yeah, just going to put something in the air fryer, wrap it up, slap it up. Like, okay. What are you putting in the burn book this week?
Okay, what I'm putting in the burn book this week is shoe culture, or this toxic shoe culture that I hate and see everywhere.
Okay.
So,
okay.
This is aimed specifically at the kind of super expensive Jordan type trainers that have the weird subculture of, like, stock exchange trading gatekeeping and all of that stuff. I hate it for multiple reasons. First reason I hate it is because I think 85% of the shoes are horrible. Doesn't matter how much people say they're worth. Doesn't matter if they're a $20 shoe or a £20,000 shoe. Most of them look horrible. I would never put them on my feet.
Mm-hmm.
The other part I hate about it is that it completely, at least in my opinion, gets the reason you buy clothes wrong. So the way it should be is that a person sees something and says, I like the look of that. The price is fine. I'm going to buy it. I'm going to wear it and I'm going to enjoy it. This is a completely different way completely different world of commerce, because not only are people, like, buying these shoes with no intention of wearing them, or even if they like them, just because they know the resale's good, which subsequently means that people who might actually want to buy and wear them don't get the opportunity to, because all of the kind of, like, seasoned veterans of this shoe game have bought them all as soon as they drop, and they're already on resale for, like, 7, 8, 10 times the price, which destroys the whole culture of enjoying shoes anyway, or clothes, any clothes. And then the fact is that even if they do like them, and even they're like, oh yeah, those are great, they basically use them as, like, collectibles, and they don't wear them because they don't want, like, creases in them, they don't want dirt on them. And, you know, even down to the fact that the box they come in needs to be kept pristine. And I just think that that's a really sad way to, like, enjoy clothes, because you're not enjoying them. It's like, I don't know, it's weird how it's become shoes, because I get how things can become collectible, and I get how things can become precious, and, like, Pokemon cards is an example, but I feel that you can still enjoy a Pokemon card while keeping it in mint condition. You cannot enjoy a shoe or an item of clothing while keeping it in absolute mint condition, because you're not able to wear it.
And if you're interested in, like, the design of shoes, like, same way that if you're interested in, like, the design of cars, like, part of what's interesting about it, part of what makes it design rather than art, I would say, is that it's, like, functional.
Functionality, yeah.
Like, or even if you want to call it wearable art, for example, which people sometimes do with clothes, like, well, if you take out the wearing aspect, then it's not wearable art. It's just theoretically art. And if you treat a shoe like a piece of art, it doesn't actually have anything to say. It doesn't have a perspective. Like, you might just like looking at it, but that's not the same as making it art. So I'm just like, if it's not worn, the shoe kind of loses meaning, in my opinion. I don't really see what its point is, unless it's something like very special, like one of fucking Elton's shoes or something, which were, by the way, all worn.
Yeah, like, so just don't... But then it becomes a collectible for a different reason. It's not collectible because of the shoe itself or the design. It's collectible because of what it's done and where it's been.
Yeah, sure. But you could also argue that those shoes are like, they are designed to be a kind of like, they are designed with an aesthetic more in mind. Like, there's a difference between a shoe that has been made for a mass market in however limited
a run.
And a shoe that has been made to be like a stage piece, which is specifically like costume. Like, no matter what like Nike do with like their new run of trainers, they're not fucking like costume. I also still think it's relevant shoes.
In that, say I went to the auction and bought a pair of match-worn David Beckham Predators like the 99 season. I would never wear them, of course, but they're collectible. But they're not collectible because of the boot design, or even though the boot design's iconic.
You would try them on.
I would sniff them.
I'd try them on.
But
I bet, I probably got bigger feet than David Beckham. He looks like he's got very dainty feet.
I think his left foot's 9 and his right foot's 8.5.
Okay, so I do have bigger feet than him, though.
It's weird that I know.
Eight and a half is small.
My feet are 8.5. I might slip my feet into them just for a feel, but I wouldn't be like wearing them out to five a side. Not that I play five a side.
Yeah, but, just to
but bet. Because they're collectible for a different reason. But these like off the shelf stock, whatever run of Air Jordan 4s, whatever, I don't even know the names, but they're not special enough to be like, I'm going to spend $4,000 on them and then they're just going to sit in my bedroom. And in a year's time, somebody will maybe give me $4,500 for them. And like, that's just what I do. That's like my identity. And they all go to these like conventions and everybody does their TikToks and stuff about like the coin flips and like they're all like bartering as if it's fucking, I don't know, Antiques Roadshow. I find it so strange, and I find the most depressing part about it is that the one function that the shoe was made for, to be worn, largely never actually happens. Because that is a way to enjoy that shoe, or shoes in my opinion. Wear them, that's what they're built for. And I think it's really, really disappointing that you're like, you get like a holy grail shoe that you've been looking at for years, and you finally find a pair, and you can't put them on because you're terrified that they'll crease. And I think you actually said it a few weeks ago, or a few months ago, that you want to enjoy your stuff more. Like, what's really disappointing is when you find like secondhand stuff that's really expensive and really nice, but it's like new, which means that the previous owner just never actually wore it because they probably thought it was too nice. This is the same thing. Buy things to enjoy them. Yeah, I find shoe culture so weird and I hate it.
I agree.
Like that specific shoe culture.
I think this is such a strong one. Like, to be honest with you, I find like sneakerhead stuff like very annoying because the shoes that they think are good and the shoes they think are shit, I'm just like, these all look basically the same. Like, I don't care. Like, I literally saw a video the other day where it was just like, what's like the worst shoe ever? And like everyone was like, oh, you know, like the Panda Dunks.
Panda Dunks, you know, that was gonna come. Yeah.
And one of them was like Panda Dunks. He was fucking wearing them, and he was like, I know I'm wearing them right now, but the Panda Dunks. And I was just like, but you like them, right? You're wearing them.
Yeah.
So are you just saying this because this is the opinion you know you're meant to have as a sneakerhead? It's like if I were a film, if I got a job like reviewing films, and all I did was just check how everybody else had reviewed the film and then review the film that way. Like, that makes no fucking sense. Like, people want your honest, I don't know, it's stupid. I also think the resale culture is just like,
it's so toxic as well.
Like, especially because it
destroys the whole industry.
And it pretends that things are a luxury that are not. Like, I mean, obviously like, Supreme, I guess, was like the moment that kind of culture went supernova.
Yeah,
I would say. Yeah. But it just seems ridiculous because it makes a luxury of things that are not luxury. Like, most shit that Supreme make is not luxury because there's no element of craft in it. Like, it's scarce, you know. It's something that very few people have, and it's expensive. But it's not actually like, it'll still be just like a fucking hoodie that says Supreme on it or whatever. Yeah. I'm like, there's nothing special about this. It's not like a Birkin or something where there truly is an element of like high craft to it. That just frustrates me as well. You know, I just think this is all just rich kids like trying to fuck each other over. It's like the First World War, you know, where they're just, people trying to steal land from their cousins. It's exactly the same thing. Like, I can't be arsed with that. What I'm putting in the burn book, it's like very boring. And actually, to be honest with you, it will reduce our likelihood of getting a sponsor. But VPNs are mostly bullshit. Like, now, not if you actually do have a good reason that you need to like conceal your whereabouts, I guess. But VPNs are really plugged at the moment, right? As in like, you can watch Netflix in another country. Like, you can watch Australian Netflix. You can watch US Netflix, or you can basically get access to other stuff. And I think for this reason, VPN is bullshit and you shouldn't bother because it doesn't really work. Like, there are the websites that purport to be like Just Watch, where they tell you what's on Netflix in different countries around the world. None of these websites are good and reliable. Like people say, oh, this is the one you should use. But they will say, oh, this film is on like, you know, South African Netflix. And it just simply isn't. Like that's what they do all the time. And without having a service like that, having access to Netflix for that country is worthless. The other big problem, of course, is that most films you actually do have access to. If you're in the UK like we are, you can get most films online. Like you might have to pay for them, but you have access to most stuff. The stuff you don't have access to is normally foreign film. And if it's, say, a Japanese film you want to watch, maybe it's on Japanese Netflix. But even if you can connect Japanese Netflix, it's in Japanese and it won't have English subs on it, because why would it? It's on Japanese Netflix. So I think this reason to get a VPN that is constantly used as an argument for getting one is absolute bullshit. And the other thing, of course, is that the VPN, a load of VPN services 100% share your data with like government agencies. And also they throttle your bandwidth. Like VPNs make your fucking internet run slower. So I just think that unless you have a really, really good reason that you truly need security, then I don't know why you get a VPN. And to be honest with you, if you do have a really good reason that you need security, there are better ways to do it. I don't think, like, VPNs are for people like me who are just like regular like computer users, not like fucking, like, I don't know anything about like concealing where I am, really.
So for me, this is a hard disagree.
Okay.
Because I use a VPN and
I've got a VPN and I get zero value from this motherfucker.
Just last weekend, I wanted to watch Lord of the Rings, and Lord of the Rings wasn't on any services I had. So I went on Unogs and typed in Lord
Unogs
of the Rings.
Unogs is shit.
But it said it was on Swedish Netflix, and I put my VPN to Sweden and I went on the Netflix and it was there.
Sure, but that is for an incredibly mainstream, like, it doesn't even have, like, there are films that I look up on there that I'm like, this is a well-known film, and it's not even on their fucking database to say, but, no, it's not anywhere. They literally don't think the film exists.
Like, that just means that no Netflix region has syndicated the rights to that. Like, that would be like The Sopranos is never going to be on Netflix, because it's HBO.
Yeah, sure.
But like my experience of using a VPN has been fully successful in terms of
to watch Lord of the Rings, though. Like, it's just like Lord of the Rings is literally, there is a whole fucking channel on Sky that shows Lord of the Rings all day, every day.
Yeah, and then that is the other reason why I need the security part of it. And we'll leave that there. But for me, I get good use out of a VPN, although I get the cheap VPN. I would not pay for, like, some of them are really expensive.
Yeah.
But from my experience, I've only had a good experience with VPNs.
Okay. Well, let me you know, clarify my point. If you want to see stuff that is like quite readily available but just happens not to be on your Netflix, sure, get a VPN. You know, sometimes you'll have like, I don't know, there'll be like 6 seasons of The American Office on your Netflix, and for some reason, you know, like the last few seasons are not on it at the moment, and you can use a VPN to go to another country, and you'll be able to get hold of it. But if you want to see like stuff that is actually hard to see in your country, it's basically worthless. Like, I've genuinely never had a success finding a film that I couldn't see here in another country. Like, and I mean, you know, when I've tried, I've been willing to pay for it here and I can't find it. And I'm like, hey, I'll use my VPN to try and find it on like Netflix elsewhere. And I'll use services like Unogs and it will say, oh, it's like here. It's in these 3 countries. And I'll try all 3 of those countries and it's not fucking there. Like, that kind of shit just annoys me. I just think it's like a fucking racket. Bullshit. Okay. But obviously, if you work for a VPN, prove me wrong and sponsor the podcast. Yeah. I think that'd be good.
This podcast brought to you by NordVPN, which apparently is shit, according to Patrick.
Yeah, I have NordVPN. It is fucking shit. Do I have NordVPN? Let me just check who I'm slandering before I say it. Probably. I don't care. Anyway, that brings us to the end of the free episode this week. We're going to catch a bunch of you over on the paid side. Thank you for your continued support. Thank you for being nice whenever I run into you in the real world. If you're related to Pete, or if you know Pete, like, obviously make sure that you drop him a text after this. Let him know what you think of his performance on this week's podcast. And we'll catch you next time. Bye.